Welcome to the Designing Hollywood podcast in association with the John Campia Show. I am your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. And this episode is sponsored by Paris Costumes. Today's guest is an Academy Award-winning costume designer known for her outstanding design and intuitive looks, which elevate each and every character she costumes. Her latest work can be seen in James Cameron's highly anticipated Avatar, The Way of Water. With the unique filmmaking experience on Avatar, The Way of Water, she and her team spent more than 5 years weaving, stitching, beading, embroidering, and braiding using a craft-based sampling-led design process and then blending it with technological innovations of her collaborators at Weta Digital to bring more of the Na'vi of Pandora to life. Turning fantasy into material reality, she created a unique rich culture and a second culture inspired by the indigenous craft techniques of Oceania to craft thousands of bespoke costume pieces and props. Previously, she collaborated with Cameron on Titanic, for which she took home the Academy Award. Later, she was tapped to do the first Avatar. One of her first movie experiences as a costume designer was Never Cry Wolf. She's also known for her work on films such as E.T., Back to the Future, Legends of the Fall, Heat, The Patriot, Minority Report, Transformers, and Aloha. She is a sought-after designer whose work is respected globally. Her additional award nods include a CDG Award nomination in Excellence in Fantasy Film for Avatar, a Golden Satellite nomination for Best Costume Design for Roland Emmerich's The Patriot, and Saturn Award nominations for Back to the Future and Minority Report. A prestigious costume designer, she epitomizes the high standards of a creative designer who can seamlessly design for any plot, be it set on a faraway planet in the dark past, in a contemporary setting, in the far future, from miniature people to giant robots. Her versatility and intelligent design elevate her films to greatness. Without further ado, please welcome the award-winning costume designer, Deborah Lynn Scott, to the Designing Hollywood Show. Deborah, it is so great to speak with you, and I warn you in advance, I'm going to geek out, and I apologize for that, because I can't not look at your filmography and just be stunned by the people you've worked with and the work that you've done. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. That's lovely. I'm ready for you to geek out all you want.
Well, you know, it's really interesting to me because, you know, you've worked with many of the heavy hitter directors in Hollywood, none of which are necessarily known for being lackadaisical in their approach to filmmaking. And from the very beginning, you have just worked on some incredible work. And I have to ask, though, was this a career path that did you choose this? Did you want to become a costume designer from an early age, or did it sort of find you? Because a lot of people began in fashion and didn't expect to go into film, but then found themselves here.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think I was at a very young age drawn to the big screen. My father was a huge movie buff, so I got to see lots of films, and I just would be transported each and every time. So that's kind of the basis of it. By the time I was about in grade school, I was sort of doing the school play acting and the costumes. And I learned how to sew, and then it was just from there on, you know, all the way through high school and the theater department, and I went to school for theater design, which I thought was really helpful. But at that, yeah, I started off doing, I did a lot of theater to begin with. And then I think the glamour of Hollywood was just too much of a draw. I really wanted to make movies.
So how did you make that transition?
Well, my first Never Cry Wolf, Charlie Martin Smith, who's the lead actor in that, we had gone to college together. So for all you students out there, you never know who you're going to meet and how it's going to go. He recommended me to Carol Ballard, and they needed somebody. And I was the one and only member of the costume department. That's just me. And so I jumped on a plane one day and sort of out of nowhere landed in Alaska and worked with those guys. And I mean, an amazing experience, really just beyond hands-on and just intimate and wonderful. We had the best time. So from there, I got introduced to Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, you jumped in really with the whole Amblin crew. I mean, you started out, you worked on Twilight Zone, the movie, then you worked on E.T., And I actually worked at E.T. first and then Twilight Zone, the movie, and then Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you? And again, when you started working on E.T., the film celebrated, I don't mean to date anyone here, but its 40th anniversary was in June of this year, 2022.
And
Did you know when you started working? I mean, obviously Spielberg had already been, Jaws and Close Encounters and Raiders had already been made, and Amblin and everybody in his circle was already huge in Hollywood. But did you know when you were working on E.T. that it was going to become that timeless classic that it became?
No, I mean, you never know how the fans, the public are going to respond to a piece of work. It was, as you say, I went to meet Steven, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's done all this incredible. He could have any costume designer in the world. My resume at the time was fairly small, and we sat down together and we just really got on. And I think at the time, Amblin was, was just getting started, and there were a lot of women worked Kathy Kennedy.
Yeah.
So, we sort of grew up together a little bit, and that film was an incredible, it was so particularly crafted, so beautifully written. I mean, the script is remarkable. And from there, from the page to the screen, Steven just nurtured this little environment of a family, and we were the family supporting the little family. So it was very, very special. And it was such a great experience. The fact that it then became popular and then became a classic is just, it just completely warms my heart. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing to have been associated with that.
Well, it's interesting because that summer of 82, Poltergeist was released on June 4th. And then a couple weeks later, E.T. was released, and it was almost both Spielberg productions, obviously, and it felt like they took place in the same neighborhood. You had ghosts on one side of the neighborhood and extraterrestrials down the other side. Now, remember, E.T. was done with quite a bit of secrecy when it was made. No one really knew what it was, even in the trailers and the advertising materials. I saw the film the first time at a public sneak. They used to release movies a couple weeks in advance to gin up word of mouth. And I remember it was, no one knew anything about it. And it was shocking to see it in that theater because people were literally, that was the first time I was in a theater where people were openly weeping. Like to the point where, I never saw I was too young to see a love story or something like that. But man, I was blown away by that experience. Were there, obviously you did a great job costuming the kids in that film. I recently rewatched the film. It felt very authentic, but you also had you got to do the government agents led by Peter Coyote and the scientists and things like that. Was that a difficult costuming job for you, or did you just have a lot of fun on that show? Because it looked like it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was so much fun. I mean, you just sort of, each movie presents a challenge and you just find a way to do it. The interesting thing about in the making of it, if you remember, you barely see an adult full body.
Yes.
You see all these images, which is why Keys became really important to Peter Coyote's character. You only really get to relate to the mother until much later on, right? So it's just such a heartfelt little story, and it was quite easy in a way, because you just had to tap it. I mean, Steven's just a master at sort of communicating with people, sort of explaining what he wanted. We went for this really Norman Rockwell, Americana, we tried to do it in a classic way, nothing showy, nothing fancy, just what would service the story and these, especially children. But the adults were, we have their outtakes from having Harrison Ford was there and, which didn't make the cut, unfortunately, but you're just from the kind of neck down.
No, so you did a great job. You got to do Halloween in that movie, dress. It's incredible.
Yeah. Science teacher, you just had to make sure, it's like presenting a character without a head. So the clothes are sort of, they just have to be symbolic of the, in their own right, so that you're like, oh, I get it. Yeah, of course, that's the science teacher. That's the, So it there was a little bit more emphasis put on it because you knew it was just going to be the only, and the voice of the actor.
Right. Well, then you were off to the races. And then, of course, you did. I've got to ask about Back to the Future, because who hasn't seen that movie a million times? Was it your idea for the vest that Michael J. Fox wears?
You know, my memory tells me that, well, we knew that Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis wanted the joke there, right? There was going to be a joke that somehow, when he came into that cafe, he was going to have to stop. And then it was like, oh my God, well, Jean Jacket doesn't do it. Nothing, you know, it's like, what were we going to, we were searching. And I do think that was my idea. And I think because I thought, well, just going through the, you know, laying awake at night going, what item of clothing would it make sense that he had that came from the 80s, looked completely alien in the 50s, but also then looked like something that they could write. So the life preserver, that's Bob Gale. Once we sort of combined forces and Zemeckis, you know, how about this idea? And then it was like, oh my God, that's, yeah, and let's make it orange. So.
Well, and then combining that with the guest jean jacket. I mean, that guest denim, I mean, you're rocking that guest denim jacket, man. That was, I mean, it's very funny because I think about, and I was talking briefly to Martika Ibarra, who also produces this podcast, about how you and Marilyn, like, kind of together cemented the look of, I'm a child of the 80s. Without the fashion of the John Hughes movies and things like Back to the Future. I mean, everybody had one of those guest jean jackets. Everybody. You know, I still remember the way the gray shoulder pad came over onto the sleeve. I mean, you had to have one. There was members only jackets, and then there was those guest denim jackets. You had to have, otherwise, who were you?
You had to have it. I mean, it was a status symbol. And it was also one of those things, like in that movie, like when Michael J. Fox comes back, it's a jean jacket. So it's not completely unfamiliar to people in the 50s. Right. But it's not a 50s coat. It's an 80s coat.
So right. You're
threading this needle of how to say that, you know, what can you put him in that, you know, doesn't go one way or the other too much. Like sneakers, everyone had sneakers in the 50s, but not those classic Nikes.
Right.
So, and you know, so he was also, he was a bit of an oddball, right? Marty McFly.
Sure. But then you got to the 50s clothes. I mean, what you dressed George in and Leah Thompson in. I mean, again, when you go back and you watch these movies, the costume design really stands out. Like especially in Back to the Future, it was sublime. What you did in that film was, I mean, every character was Biff Tannen's wardrobe is great. It was fantastic. And then I got to ask you this too. I mean, I'm a kid of the 80s. I got to ask, you dressed Madonna. You got to dress Madonna. And who's that girl?
Yeah, that was a trip. We had so much fun, and that was complete opposite, right? You have an iconic person.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to put her in? It's like, oh my gosh. She was extremely collaborative, very, very into her costumes. And we just sort of said, you know, it can be a little odd. People know, you know, you look at Madonna and you sort of expect it a bit. So we got to do, we just went crazy. The tutu, and the, you know, whatever. It was like, have fun. And I think it was pretty fun. It was pretty fun. And I think it looked pretty good.
Oh, I thought so too. It's great.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun on that.
And then, I mean, again, it's you seem to be associated in the 80s and 90s with these incredible looks, because I would be remiss, Legends of the Fall. I mean, in the 90s, man, I don't think I ever dated a woman that didn't have a Legends of the Fall videotape in her house with that Brad Pitt with his flowing locks or whatever. I mean, you couldn't compete with that. And you dressed, you did Sharon Stone in Sliver. Her follow-up to Basic Instinct, she looked incredible in that. And all the way up to in the mid-90s, Heat. You dressed De Niro and Pacino in the same movie.
Same movie. How lucky. See, this is what I'm talking about. I had a real good role with, like, unbelievable handsome men there for a while. You know, Anthony Hopkins, Brad Pitt in the same movie.
Come on.
united with Henry Thomas from E.T. It was just, and Aidan Quinn, I mean, get serious. You can't make them look bad.
No.
There's no way.
Now, I have to ask you, did you, for the suits and things, I mean, everything from Hoffa that you worked on, did you like to build your own costumes? Did you buy a lot? Did you have relationships with designers? Or did you like to have a team that built things from scratch? What was your modus operandi in a lot of these films?
Well, on the period films, I like to do a combination of build my own things. A lot of times, like Back to the Future and Hoffa, built from period fabrics, you know, trying to sort. At the time, you could still source those wonderful period fabrics, which weren't being made at the time. So that made it a little easier. But I love to make things from scratch. And I also really love to collect vintage clothing and try to use it when I could. Because that's authentic. There's no more authentic than an actual garment from the actual period creating.
Well, it's interesting to me that nowadays, I mean, there's so much vintage material out there. Do you collect things when you're not working? Do you collect vintage pieces? You're like, maybe I could use this here, there, some other time.
I used to do that. And then I was just like, you know what? It's too much stuff. But having said that, I have an amazing collection, a garage full of trims, beads, gloves, I mean, accessories, jewelry. That I can't resist because you can squish it all into it, you know. But yeah, I've used my jewelry over and over, and that's been really fun. And it's nice to have it. It's a good memory. But you know, I think costume designers, your work lives on in the movie.
Sure.
It does, right? So it's so captured there that you don't have to worry about the rest of it.
When you were growing up wanting to get into the business, did you have designers? Were you a fan of like Bob Mackie or Edith Head? Did you have costume design influences? And were there films for you growing up that were touchstones in terms of the design behind them?
In terms of costumes?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a huge lover of old movies. So, I mean, you can, the list, you know, Ori Kelly, Adrian, Walter Plunkett. I mean, you just... You know, I would watch them over and over and over, mesmerized, because those movies of the 40s, the 50s, I mean, it was all about the costumes. I mean, can we just talk about the same year Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind came out? You can't.
Directed by the same guy.
And as a child, you know, it's amazing to me, and it still lasts with kids today. Like some of those things that spark your imagination stay with you forever. And those were two unbelievably beautifully designed movies, immersive in costume. And, you know, I've seen a lot of movies over my lifetime. And there's also just kind of movies that inspire me, not the costumes per se, but the like Last of the Mohicans, the costumes are beautiful. The movie's amazing. That made me really want to work with Michael Mann. And I was lucky enough to do Heat with him. Go back to like how evocative something like Splendor in the Grass. You know, you have two great movie stars in that just look amazing and look completely at ease in their clothing. So, and then I love the Mission. I was thinking of that because it's so indigenous and I mean, De Niro looks amazing. It's just, you know, it's the costumes work together so well.
Well, you also did, I mean, I found it kind of fascinating that you did both Wild Wild West and then Roland Emmerich's The Patriot, basically in one year after another. So you were dealing with, for whatever anybody says about Wild Wild West, the film had an incredible design aesthetic. And I love the Western costumes. They weren't totally period. They were clearly had design behind them as well, obviously, but they were great. Your costume work in Wild Wild West was terrific. And then also The Patriot was, you went from the Old West back to the Revolutionary War, so rich and lush. Even today, when you think of The Patriot, some of those battle scenes were incredible. And working on films like period costume stuff from the Old West or stuff from America's past, how important is authenticity? Or do you get a little bit of opportunity or wiggle room to bring your own flair to something as opposed to following history to the letter.
Yeah, I think you have two really good examples there of opposite things. The Patriot was very, very much based on historic research, you know, so really digging deep into that period, those uniforms, you know, just the deep dive that it took to figure out all that was really, it was a lot of fun. And it was a lot of work. It was a big crew. We built almost all of the movie. And, you know, the opposite, Wild Wild West, which is also period, but with that, as you say, that twist.
Right.
So I could sort of silhouettes of those and then just kind of tweak it. And it became this sort of, you know, that sort of a deconstruction that I used with the girls that followed Kenneth Branagh around, that, you know, and now people think it's like I see people on the street and it's like, hold on a second though, the steampunk thing. And they half credit that movie a little bit.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that movie gets, obviously it gets sort of, I love that show growing up. I love Robert Conrad, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, I think that movie kind of gets a bad rap, but the design work in it is exquisite. And what you came up with, I think that's absolutely true. You defined sort of this. There's never been a movie really that had that much of a budget to create that steampunk aesthetic.
Yeah. And also because, I mean, you know, again, I think it was a shame it didn't do better. I think it had some very good, obviously very good actors in it. But the ability to do those clothes and kind of just that little tweak where you didn't have to age them down, and, you know, they could be sort of just bright and out there and obvious it's a different aesthetic for sure.
You've tended to work with directors that are known as being sticklers for detail. I mean, Michael Mann, Michael Bay, of course, James Cameron. These are people that don't allow any details in their films to get by them. What's it like working for exacting directors like a Michael Mann or like a James Cameron? Do you thrive in that environment, or would you rather be more unconstrained?
Very good question. I mean, of course you thrive in that environment because you have a very high bar to hit. They're not going to, you know, that they're going to dictate and want a level. They're going to support you in getting to that level. And there's, you know, the hard work that it takes to do that is incredibly rewarding. Incredibly rewarding. I've had other times where some smaller films I've done where directors have sort of trusted me more to sort of take it the way I want to, maybe with just a little bit of conversation and, you know, a lot of collaboration, but sometimes it's really just talking about it or talking about the characters.
To get to your working relationship with James Cameron, you've done three films with him, two of which are two of the biggest movies of all time. Both of which, I mean, it was, for those people who weren't in Hollywood back when Titanic was being made, people in the business were looking at it as Cameron's folly. I mean, everyone's like, what is this movie? They're down in Rosarito. What the hell are they doing down there spending all this money? Well, anybody who knows anything would say, don't bet against Jim Cameron, ever. The man's never lost. I mean, people might say, well, what about his first movie, Piranha 2, The Spawning? Yeah, that doesn't count. I mean, he comes on and the man has never missed. And whether he's making an action comedy like True Lies or he's doing a sequel to Alien, I mean, look how that worked out for everybody. And so Titanic, again, I recently revisited that film. My God, I mean, there's a reason you won an Academy Award. But those costumes in that film, I don't even want to know how many you had to make, especially how many doubles you had to make when they're flooding the sets. But what was it like for you to begin collaborating with James Cameron on Titanic? And how did that working relationship, he didn't make a movie for 10 years, and then you took on Avatar, which we'll get to, but what's he like? Is he fun to work for?
He's a lot. He can be a lot of fun. He's very hard working. So you know, he's going to work hard every single day. I don't know when he sleeps. His mind is always racing. You're absolutely invited into this, his imagination, which is beyond. And he's got all this technical, that's the part that he loses me on, because he knows everything about cameras and lighting and, you know, deep diving. And, you know, he's just a genius in that way. So when he puts his imagination on top of all that stuff, that he, the foundation that he's created for himself in the world, it's pretty mind-boggling. Titanic was interesting because at that time in the US of A, and all the period dramas were being done in England. You know, no one wanted to do a period drama. It was never going to make money, not let alone the money that we actually spent to make it, you know, building the ship, the whole ship, building everything's practical right on that thing. So going to Rosarita, building that tank, I mean, it was just amazing. So that, you know, he invests, like, he's allowed, luckily, because he's articulate, powerful, creative, to have the money to do that. But he's never going to let the movie going public down, because the bar is so high. And we got together on that. I think actually just because he liked Legends of the Fall, and he thought, oh, she can handle period. She'll be okay. And so, and then you just have this, you know, it, that period of Titanic, there's such immense research, because you have the photographs. Right. And the support to go around the world and collect garments and, you know, just nail it. Like there's not going to be a moment or a costume that isn't perfect. Again, he sets that bar.
I would imagine that Titanic for a costume designer had to have been a dream job, simply because of the diversity of the costumes that you were able to create. You got all the best of both worlds.
Absolutely. And if there's anywhere that the steerage stuff is super fun, because we could bring in different, you know, different ethnic groups and different kinds of people. And I would think, like, maybe that was the most kind of a little bit more on the fantasy side. Like, we kind of upped the game a little bit, because Jim didn't want them to all, you know, it wasn't going to be sad down there. It was a place that she wanted to be.
Right.
You know, it was fun down there. It was lively. And
it was date night.
And all that. And then, yeah, totally. And then the first class, I mean, who wouldn't want to do that? You know, top to toe, everything perfect. And the uniforms were super fun. And we had that, do you remember the mirrored thing where we were shooting?
Yep.
We only had one half of the ship, so we would have to, all the logos had to be backwards.
Yes.
And that was a little mind-boggling. But we got through that.
Well, was it rough, though, having, when they started flooding the ship, that how many multiples did you have on for each character?
Well, I think we were up to, for Kate especially, probably about 24 of the same thing. And it was all, and, you know, it was a pretty simple dress by that point. It was a very kind of, I think, period appropriate, that it was sort of this sort of nuance where people were starting to loosen up on the corset and, you know, slowly going to fade into the 20s and that sort of diaphanous thing. But it was a lot of upkeep, because the water just, it doesn't matter if it was chlorinated or salt water, it just destroyed everything. So we spent a long, many, many months before, because we had to almost shoot in sequence. We couldn't sink the ship for real until we shot all the scenes on the ship.
Right.
So all that time we were building what we called the water clothes. So, you know, skirt, you know, things that we could, and then throw that life vest over so you don't have to worry about the detail too much. And, you know, so things that could just die in the ocean, basically. So that was crazy.
Well, you got through it.
Also, yeah, we got through that. I'd like to just one more thing about that, because the other thing that Jim's really a master of is that he loves clothes. And even though he doesn't design the clothes, but he appreciates what you give him. So those sequences, like when she's wearing that dress and floating, you know, let's just do some slow motion of this. You know, I mean, my goodness, who wouldn't love the costume? It looks amazing. Or when the sound quality, when she steps on the railing for her suicide, and you hear tinkle, tinkle, tinkle of the beads.
Right.
Right. I didn't tell him to do that. He's a genius that way. He knows how to photograph and give you the best of what he's got in front of him.
Which has got to be gratifying for you, because so often I'm sure you've made things and like, well, couldn't they have shot the back? Couldn't you have seen? I spent 6 months sourcing that fabric.
Get this.
Yeah. Is that all we're going to get?
The shoes were.
Yeah. The shoes are obviously, I don't think shoes get, unless you're working on a Quentin Tarantino movie, you don't get enough feet shots. There's got to be all the great, you know, it's too bad. I mean, I didn't know much about shoes until I started watching Sex and the City and Manolo Blahnik. I'm like, I'd never heard of Manolos. Now I'm all well versed. So yes. Let's see those pictures of those shoes. That began a very fruitful collaboration with James Cameron. But this is the thing I've been wanting to ask. Obviously, you finally arrive and you're going to work on Avatar. But as we all famously know, here's a movie that won an Academy Award for Best Cinematography, and yet so much of it's virtual. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you can't just conjure costumes for alien races out of thin air. I mean, even though a lot of it's got to be digitized or whatever, it still has to be designed.
Yes.
Now, tell us about, I'd love to know, what was that initial conversation with James Cameron where he explained to you what he was going to do to make Avatar, and how would you fit into that?
Well, the interesting thing, I was the second designer on the movie. So I came to the party a little bit late, but I came in like just plunked down right in the middle of like, what the heck is going on here? Yeah. So it was like, he just wanted me to come down and solve a couple problems for him. I went to New Zealand like that night, literally. And we sort of just dove right into it. And it was an incredible fast learning curve because I'd never, and you know, most people hadn't worked like that before.
Right.
So I had to catch up really fast, but I spent a year and a half on that film because after we went into post, and what became very obvious to Jim, and I was the lucky recipient of that, was that we needed to build all those costumes. That you cannot, as much as you can design on paper and computer artists, it had to be built because you can't, it's the same thing as like, everything looks too, you can't replicate that. You can't show the dimension of those costumes. So when we went into The Way of Water, that was just the mandate. You were going to make all the costumes for every actor, full scale, front, back, side, the entire thing. So that you handed this real life thing. So the difference between Avatar Way of Water and the original was that we were now going to feature a clan of people that lived on the water and in the water, and that all the characters we were going to be filming performance capture and underwater, which we did. And we also made all the costumes proof of concept that they could work underwater and do what they needed to do and look beautiful.
Now, that's just astonishing what you just told me about how, like you said, because they don't have, like, even water was a hard thing to create in CG originally. They had to figure out how to write particle. The physics of water was very difficult to capture in the computer. So I would imagine once you submerge costumes, like you said, in the water, and the way everything has to react is insane. Now, I have to ask you, in the first Avatar, you had the Omatikaya people. Now we have, and I haven't seen the movie yet, so I can't, if I get this miss, it's the Metakainas? Okay, the Metakaina is the name of the new race of the Na'vi that we meet, the new ethnicity of the Na'vi that you just explained. So what was the mandate in the beginning when Mr. Cameron told you that you had a new race? And obviously, because they made Avatar in New Zealand, you have the South Sea Islanders. You can see that there's like Maori-esque tattoos on their faces and things like that. How much research did you do into South Sea Island culture, and how much did that inform the design work of the Metakainas?
We did a tremendous amount of research, but not only in, we kind of concentrated on Polynesia in general, like all those islands, all those oceanic clans and things like that. But we also researched the Arctic, the Antarctic, off China, off India, indigenous peoples that live on and in the water. So you start to see a lot of correlations between all of these, you know, all of these different cultures. And concentrating where we did, and yes, we were in New Zealand, the tattoos are inspired by, you can, they're inspired by people who use body art all over the world. So with performance capture, the technological advances that the digital companies have made puts more pressure than on the costume department and every department, quite frankly. I mean, we were capturing more, facial capture was enhanced, the fingers, the toes, because the Navi people are barefoot. You had to get the articulation in their feet. And then you have to, the costumes, Jim, we had a tremendous amount of research of putting costumes not only on actors so they could feel the weight, interact with the pieces, right? And then inform the digital people, like, how does that move underwater? Well, how do you do that? They don't have a program for that. They don't know, because these garments, it's not like putting a t-shirt underwater, something that they know, right? We've made up all these costumes. It's all created. So they don't have the simulation program necessarily to tell them how that shell thing would work. So we would build the shell thing, put it in the tank, photograph it, and that was used as research too for them.
All of the indigenous people that live in and around the water all over the planet were all part of your design aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, they were definitely part of the research. We sort of concentrated in the war, eventually, in the Polynesian area, because also that's supposed to be warm there, right? We weren't going to. Okay. So, but you see, you find a lot of things, all peoples around the world, all these clans are, for the most part, they do a couple of things. They use their environment to create their clothing, and they are usually quite decorative. You know, the body art is really important. The hair is really important. And they have rules. So we built the world, we built the clans, we built the family, and we built the characters within all those steps.
Wow, okay.
So all has to kind of flow together. We definitely settled on, you know, Jim really wanted that kind of, for the Mekaina people, that kind of Polynesian hair, which is not only beautiful, but very common Hawaii even. You know, it's like, sure. It's a very common kind of hair, that black, lovely, and it looks amazing underwater, which is also, you know, so that was fun. And we got to, I designed all the hair for the Navi as well.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. And all the, most of the body art for those, there's kind of the human decoms in there, and the Navi people, but it was a big challenge, but it was really wonderful to be able to do characters sort of from top to bottom, skin, hair, the whole thing. And not have to give up too much control of that to other departments, because they really had to work together. You know, sure. They're very specific people. Yeah.
Now, were there various in terms of textiles or fabrics or things that you concentrated on for the Metakaina people, in terms of like, I don't know, did you make stuff out of kelp, or was it fabric? I mean, where do you go to look for the kind of materials that they would construct their garments from?
Well, we definitely had, we had some rules, right? That we knew the Navi people, whether they were Matakaya from the first film or the additional Mekaina, that these people were crafts oriented and really, and good weavers. They're good with their hands. They know what to do. The Mekaina have a more highly evolved way of crafting, because they were more of a peaceful people, and they lived ultimately in a more idyllic kind of situation.
Sure.
They both use anything. So anything in their environment, they'll use an animal skin, fish, a reptile, a bird, a plant, a flower, a shell, a leaf, whatever it is. So if whatever you find on the beach, around the beach, in Pandora, which adds that extra sparkle, because the coral can be really fantastic, right? So we used all those kinds of ideas when constructing the design for that. And I was pretty notorious with my crew going out and kind of beach combing, and I'd come back with like, here, let's make a costume out of this. Isn't this cool? So we had a lot of fun. And I think, and Jim was really, he was a lover of the PowerShell, which in terms of kind of color, they're, the two clans have a different color scheme.
Right.
And once the Sullys get to the reef and live there, they start to adapt more. And, you know, but the color scheme of the Metkayana is really based on that PowerShell. And for me, the sunset. Sunset on a beach is, you know, you get those luscious oranges and yellows and, you know, all that. So you stay away from kind of those earth tones, those rainforest kind of reds and blacks and things like that. But it's very expressive. If you look at a PowerShell, there's this like greens, blues, purple, everything's in there.
And I love the fact that you can really differentiate the two cultures.
I think that, yeah.
At least in what I've seen. I mean, I'm seeing it Thursday night at 7 o'clock in IMAX 3D. I can't wait. I mean, it was very funny because the first, when I saw the first Avatar, I was with my mom, who was at the time 70, very unimaginative woman. She's very, very much a pragmatist. And she didn't have a whole lot of use for the science fiction, fantasy, and horror that I loved. But I took her to see Avatar. And it was the first time in my life when the movie was over, we saw it in IMAX 3D. She was completely speechless. Her eyes were as big as saucers. And she just turns to me and she says, how did they do that? And that was the first and only time in my life I saw my mother completely enraptured in her own imagination. And yeah. I felt like, oh, finally, we're on the same page, Mom.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And I think that's what Jim's trying to do, and I think absolutely accomplished with The Way of Water, is that this concept of big movie making. Get in the theater, immerse yourself in that film. He invites you in there, and it's absolutely a thrill ride. You know, it's so immersive, and it has a heart to it. It has a family story. Characters go through lots of different things, as they always do, but it's very much it's just much bigger, better, more than the first one. It just is. I mean, he's never going to repeat himself, that Jim Cameron. He's going to always add something incredible in the mix.
And also, I mean, he said in interviews that he's already shot 95% of the third film, and he's talking about the fourth film coming to ravaged Earth. For whatever, I can only imagine what that's going to be like. But now let me ask you this, as a, not that you're done in your career at all, but you know, you've seen the film business really change. I mean, in terms of where you began working on Never Cry Wolf, and now you're working on Avatar 2, The Way of Water, which is one of the biggest movies ever made, even though both of those two sides of the spectrum are about the natural world kind of things. What would you say has changed as far as the costume designer's role? Obviously, it's not going anywhere because, as you pointed out, just because you're making something predominantly digitally, you still need, the computer doesn't know how fabric is going to move underwater. Yeah. That's why you had to build everything. But how do you feel about the business now as opposed to when you started?
Oh my gosh, it seems like it's just gotten bigger and better, bigger, you know, just... It continues to sort of outdo itself. There was a magic, I gotta say, of, you know, being on the set, like on an ET, or when you have an actual camera and you don't know what you're capturing, and you go to the dailies the next day and you're just like, oh, I almost got, you know, it's like, you know, that sort of, you had to really use your eyes and you had to be physically there on the set. So as we move into more films like Avatar, and I think the Marvel world and things like that, where you have this incredible, you know, VFX component that, as you say, costume design is always going to be important, and possibly more important, because you're not capturing necessarily the live garment, but it has to go through all these steps and have all this proof of concept to get to the visual, virtual, real thing. So the skill base that we need to grow as costume designers is immense. And I think that we're allowed a seat at that table. We should be there. It's like, you don't just drop off a design on paper and go home, right? You have to hang in there. You got to do that work. And it's the same work you've always done, but you might have to add some skills to it. So I have, you know, who knows what's going to happen. I mean, we have shot a lot of film three. I've designed a lot of film three. And I think if people like film two, film three will blow your mind again. It's unbelievable, that man's imagination and where he'll take audiences. But you know, even in 2 years from now, I'm kind of anticipating having to learn new things to get my costumes across the finish line in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I as I said, I can't wait to see this film. I can't wait to see what he's doing. And it's, you know, Jim Cameron has always done the R&D for the business. I mean, all the way back to when he was working on The Abyss, and he's creating software, the pseudopod sequence, the water probe sequence gave way to what became the T-1000 in Terminator 2. And then, of course, that led to things like being able to do Jurassic Park. And now, again, the work on Avatar is no one's come close to creating these immersive virtual environments.
And, you know, him developing, inventing, and, you know, on this performance capture underwater is absolutely groundbreaking. And the, you know, I had to work developing those suits along with the technicians, because it's like, here's the technical part. Now get it on the body. So that was about an eight month process. And I would do an incarnation. And at first they had all these wires and, you know, people look like Michelin men, and you're like, well, that's never going to work, because they can't move their arm. You know, you have to be, they're basically naked under the water. So
yes.
You can't have all that stuff in the way. So we got it down to, if you see any footage of the behind the scenes, I mean, it's a very sleek silver wetsuit with markings on it. And it was a long time in process. So that alone, my goodness, how many people in the world are going to be able to do that, or been lucky enough to do that, you know, and participate on the level of all this groundbreaking work?
With so many people now wanting to get into this field now, what advice could you give to, say, an aspiring kid who might want to do what you're doing?
Well, I think that education, number one. It's like, there's no way that you're going to stroll in there and be, you know, you gotta get yourself educated. And I think that's, a lot of people do come at it from a fashion side. I came at it from a theater side. So I think the skills that you learn in the theater in terms of building things, you know, the character development as opposed to a fashion element is very important for filmmaking. And I think to realize that everyone's not going to be is going to be a designer, but it does take a village. You have incredible artists, makers, hat makers, jewelry makers, you know, tons of people who, not to mention set crews and behind the scenes people that really, really support any idea that you might have. And I was lucky enough on Avatar: The Way of Water to work mostly with Weta Workshop in New Zealand, which is like, it's like having your own atelier. I mean, it's like you could walk in there and say, so I have this idea. And they're like, sure. And you'd sit down and we would do these designs and we'd look at them and I'd say, okay, what is that? Is that leather? Is that flax? You know, we just create and then take it from there. Like, okay, we can do that. We'll do this. We'll do, you know, we learned to do it together. We developed a language there. So really gratifying. So I think that's a little off point to someone coming in the business. You got to want to work hard.
It's not off point at all.
Yeah. You're going to have to work hard. You're going to have to take your, you know, lucky breaks and back them up with something, and know what's best for you too, you know?
Well, Deborah Scott, can people follow you on social media?
You know, I don't have a social media account. Should I?
I don't know. Some do. You know, going on Instagram. If nothing else, show the kids at home what you've been doing for the last couple of years, all the way back to Streets of Fire.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, Avatar, I've been 5.5 years on the film so far, and it's almost like you're just in hibernation a little bit. You're like in a fantasy world, and people are like, where'd you go?
Yeah, it's every 10 years you get to emerge with a new Avatar movie. But I mean, this has been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much for doing this. I'll take care of all the technical difficulties, by the way.
Okay. You're going to make it beautiful.
It beautiful. I mean, this has been so fantastic. And again, I'm such a huge fan of yours. And I didn't even ask you about stuff like Minority Report.
My God. That was a blast.
I can only imagine.
You know, anytime I get to reunite with Steven Spielberg is a day in heaven. So, you know, he's a genius and a master.
Oh, yeah. And I love the fact you kind of bracket, you know, you worked on E.T., you worked on Minority Report, many years between them, but still science fiction epics both. It's been great to speak with you today. I'm a huge fan. I can't wait to see what you do next. I can't wait to see this movie. I think it's going to make all the money this holiday season. everyone's going to go see it. And I just wonder, you know, after the first movie came out, people were like having Pandora withdrawals. There was that people were talking about being depressed because they couldn't actually go live in that bioluminescent paradise. So I wonder if we're going to get that same thing 10 years or 13 years on.
Well, yeah. I hope so. Cause we get to visit some new parts of Pandora. And I think also, you know, don't worry. Cause film 3 is not going to be another decade. It's going to be sooner than that.
Right.
So we'll, you know, hang on for the ride, you know, really. It's going to be great. And go to the theater, see it big.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think you should only see it in IMAX 3D, you know, given a choice.
Yes.
Best 3D ever done.
Unbelievable. Those people are crazy. It's so good.
Well, Deborah Scott, thank you for joining us here on the Designing Hollywood podcast. I can't wait to see what you do next. And everybody should go see Avatar, The Way of Water. It opens Thursday the 16th, at least domestically here in the United States. Go see it over and over and over again, because I want to see movies 3, 4, 5. You know you're going to be stuck on Pandora for what, film 6? They're going to make that many, 3 more? You're not done yet.
Not done yet. We'll see. We're going to see how that goes. But yes, go to the theater. And thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute.
It has been my honor to speak with you.
Anytime.
Well, thanks very much. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Paris Costumes. Paris Costumes has been a part of the history of the European theater, film, and television industry since 1856. And has become 21st century tailors. A special thank you to founder and executive producer Martika Ibarra, co-founder, costume designer, the legendary Marilyn Vance, and of course, John Campia from The John Campia Show. Thank you to all of our viewers for tuning in, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Tune in to the audio version wherever you listen to podcasts. I am, of course, your host, Robert Meyer Burnett, and you can find me on Instagram at RMBurnett, or find me on Twitter at BurnettRM, or on YouTube at PostGeekSingularity. Thanks very much. Like, subscribe, and give us your comments. What would you like to see on the channel? Right down below. Thanks very much for watching, and we'll see you on the next episode of Designing Hollywood.